as we go to air, we've just heard about the outcome of a meeting between the Indigenous Voice to Parliament Referendum Working Group and the Prime Minister and several of his ministers. But the thorny question of whether the Voice to Parliament will have any real power remains, and it's instructive to look at New Zealand's experience. The very busy Dana Morse joins us again. She is, of course, ABC political reporter based in Canberra. Dana's from the Planjamarana Padawa mob in Tassie. And Dominic O'Sullivan, welcome back to you, my friend. Last time we were talking about the Fiji elections, but you're just too damn versatile. Dominic is Professor of Political Science at Charles Sturt University and an adjunct professor at the Auckland University of Technology. He's a New Zealand Maori man, and he's written an interesting piece for The Conversation about Maori democratic representation. First of all to you, Dana Morse, what's the latest from Parliament House?
Good evening, Philip. Yeah, it's a really interesting week here in Canberra, the first of two sitting weeks where we were expecting and have now seen a couple of movements on legislation around the Voice to Parliament. So the first is the machinery bill. So that has passed the Senate this evening, passed unanimously, I understand, the few abstentions from the vote. Now, that bill is not on the actual wording of the referendum. It's on the rules, because we haven't had a referendum in close to 30 years. It used to be that every time we changed the rules for the federal election process, we would also update the referendum process. We basically stopped doing that a while ago. So they had to update all of the rules and regulations around how referendums are run in Australia. And it was actually more contentious than you might think to what seems like a pretty simple rule book update. Essentially, the government got bogged down in debate with the opposition on the pamphlet. So that's something that the government had hoped not to put out this time around. It's a pamphlet that's given to every household in Australia that details the yes and the no case. The government was, their argument was essentially, it's, you know, much easier to put this sort of information online. There's also, you know, the question of who is going to write it, who is going to fact check it. But the opposition said it was an absolutely essential part, particularly because so many parts of Australia don't have good internet access, especially out in regional and remote communities. So as a concession to get the coalition support on the bill, they've given them the pamphlet. There'll be a pamphlet going out to every house. And there are a couple of other points of contention as well during this process.
Dana, Albo will make an announcement tomorrow.
We believe that he will. So this is on the other piece of legislation that we had been told would be hitting the lower house next week. I think that is still the plan. But what's going to happen is we understand that the referendum working group, the advisory body that's tasked with telling the government how to proceed successfully towards a referendum, and also looking at the question that will be asked of the public at a referendum and the constitutional amendment, so the words that will go into the constitution should a yes vote get up. We understand they've agreed to a form of words. They've had a meeting with the Prime Minister. They've all, the phrase that was said to me by somebody who had knowledge of the meeting was that everybody had given a little bit of ground. And then into tonight, the six people who were there from the referendum working group were going to meet with the other 14 or 15 odd members that couldn't be there in Canberra today and try and get them on board with that form of words. We believe that will then go to the cabinet tomorrow, and we could be hearing an announcement on those words tomorrow.
Dom, you wrote a book in 2020 about Indigenous citizenship and sovereignty. called We Are All Here to Stay, and you question in your latest article whether consultation as proposed is enough. You seem underwhelmed.
I am underwhelmed by consultation, but it's important to be clear that while the Prime Minister did signal that that's what would be involved in a recent speech, we haven't seen the words and we haven't seen the legislation that will set out the makeup of this body and what it can do and, by extension, what it can't do.
If consultation is weak participation, what do you see as strong?
Well, I think one of the critical elements here is that the voice is not just a voice to Parliament, but also a voice to the executive branch of government. And there has been some suggestion that that might come out of the proposal to allay the fears of that some people have been raising. But I think why a voice to the executive branch of government is important is because it's in the bureaucracy which advises ministers where the finer details of policy are worked out. It's often within departments of state that policy ideas are formulated.
So and active participation in decision-making and policy.
That's right. And while the voice won't be a parliamentary chamber, it won't decide on the final outcome or have the exclusive right to decide. There are strong forms of participation that go beyond the idea that we'll ask you what you think, but then we'll make the decision for you. And I think that's the risk with consultation.
Dominic, there's an argument that there are elected Indigenous political representatives who can do that already.
Well, they're not representatives of Indigenous people. And I think that's the fundamental difference. And because their accountability is to a much broader constituency, and they have to continue to attract the support of that broader constituency to be re-elected to Parliament.
Dona, are you hearing a more nuanced discussion now than treaty or voice?
I think so. I think it's definitely moving in that direction. But, of course, we have been bogged down in a lot of the detail here politically, and I was earlier today speaking with some members that had travelled to Canberra for the No campaign to have their message heard, and they were saying that people in their community still don't know what the voice is. So we've really focused this debate pretty heavily on Canberra and other sort of major cities where there are a lot of people, a lot of activists and a lot of voices coming out of those places. But it doesn't do us a lot of good if there's still people who haven't even been able to form an opinion because they still don't even know what this thing is. And I think that will be addressed, but it should be done with some urgency by both sides of the campaign and the responsibility of the government in the civics education campaign as well.
Dominic, an arrangement was established in New Zealand in 1867 to ensure a Maori voice in rather than to Parliament. Tell us about it.
Well, it's fundamentally different because by virtue of being in Parliament, those representatives are able to serve in Cabinet, or if they're members of the opposition, they're able to participate in the parliamentary function of holding the ministry to account or helping to hold the ministry to account. So that's the fundamental difference. And obviously when people serve as ministers, they're able to bring a Māori perspective to that work. And although Māori people are elected to Parliament from what we call general constituencies, those who come from the designated Māori seats are able to approach politics and policy from a distinctive cultural perspective, and they're able to have regard for colonial context and the ways that they think about things, and they're able to speak to voters in their own language.
Now, the foundation for this, of course, was the treaty in 1840.
That's right. There's a treaty signed really before the colonial project got underway. And it wasn't a treaty of colonisation, but various events happened that explain why we've got to the point of a colonial state now. But the treaty provides a very powerful moral, political and legal framework for addressing some of those constraints on independence that colonialism creates. So there's an administrative tribunal that the government established which can hear claims from any Maori person alleging breaches of the treaty. And that in itself helps to keep Maori rights and interests always at the forefront of public debate. The debates are sharply contested, and they're not always resolved in ways that Maori people think are just, but they're never off the political agenda either.
So the treaty routinely fails to work as Maori think it should, Dominic.
Oh, yeah, certainly, because there were three elements to the treaty. The first allowed the British Crown to establish government over its own people. The second guaranteed Maori people continued authority over their own affairs and resources. And the third gave Maori the rights and privileges of what in those days were called British subjects, but what's evolved into New Zealand citizenship. So where the contest arises is when people get a sense that perhaps the government is overreaching its authority by interfering too much in Maori lives, by alienating land, not ensuring that government works as well for Maori people as it does for everybody. A recent case, which I think will resonate strongly with First Nations people in Australia, involved the unjustifiable taking of Maori children from their families by the state, and that was heard by the Waitangi Tribunal, and it was very clearly held that there was state overreach in that regard. So people can make those arguments with recourse to what many people refer to as the founding agreement of the modern state.
Dana, it sounds as though there should be more dialogue between Maori and Australian Indigenous people. Perhaps more could be shared, even though clearly there are differences between the situations.
I think so. I think, though, in that sharing process, I mean, New Zealand has had a treaty established with its Indigenous people since the 19th century. Australia has not, and Australia as a country is, very uncomfortable with our colonial history and even acknowledging that. And really, I think, I've made this point previously that the voice isn't a perfect piece of policy, and nor should it be expected to be. You don't get to go the whole hog and end up with a treaty and a tribunal when the current system is nothing. We haven't had anything since basically ATSIC in 2006 or 2005. You've had all these splintered organisations that are trying to give a capture the national interest, but a voice would be a step in that direction. But it's something that takes time, and it's something that, you can't rush, particularly when we've seen with this process to where we are now has taken 5 years, or it's 5-6 years, and the broader Australian public is still incredibly uncomfortable, and that's why we're hearing things about high court challenges and this is dividing along the lines of race. There are good arguments on both sides of whether or not we should have a voice, but we're not hearing a lot of the logical ones from the no camp in particular.
Dana Morse, ABC political reporter, thanks for making time for us, Dana. I know you've had a very long day.
And a long one tomorrow, Philip.
And thank you to Dominic Dominic. Dominic O'Sullivan, Professor of Political Science at Charles Sturt University, based in Canberra.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.